Clubhouse.
Join us every Friday in March for Love It or Leave It March Madness Edition. Because after all, we all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Welcome to March Madness Edition. This week we're covering Black Swan from 2010. Joining Caroline and I for this edition is our favorite Will from So I'm Watching the Show. Or I'm sorry, our favorite Will with one L from So I'm Watching the Show. Will. Hey, Will. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm pretty good.
Well, we bring you on for a lot of weird stuff that usually has some kind of bizarre sex in it. Bridgerton, I think, last happiest season, which didn't have sex, but it was, you know, an avant-garde.
It was
a niche Christmas film. Now we're taking you on a Natalie Portman ride.
Uh-huh.
So. Before we get into the movie, what's everyone's history with this? Will, as our guest, you can go first. Like, is this a movie you saw back in 2010 when it came out? Is this like a new edition for you?
Oh, boy. Okay. So I'm going to be bringing a lot to this, but so
I'm strapping in for it. Let's go.
I grew up dancing from the ages of 5 to 12. I did ballet, and for context, I was actually very good. I kind of have the history in the ballet world. On top of that, I was 13 when the Star Wars movies came out, so I'm like a huge Natalie Portman fan. I love sci-fi, fantasy, you know, glamour, all that stuff. This had a huge glamour aspect to it. I remember the first photos of her in the like tutu, the Black Swan tutu, and it was very avant-garde because I feel like ballet, the arts are things that movies can frequently phone in. They're like, yeah, just put a tutu on her, she'll be fine.
Yeah.
But this, you could tell, was like painstakingly detailed and painted, and they were really taking it seriously. A little bit of context is I was 24 years old when I saw this, and I went with my friends. We loved it. We were all about it. I was kind of obsessed. Like, I was kind of obsessed with it. And I saw it maybe a good 5-6 times, like, right when it came out. And then I have not seen it again until we watched it for this. And I was amazed by how much of it was seared in my mind.
In a good way, though? I mean, what, rewatching after so long, was it still hitting you in the same way?
Well, yes. It did watch different to me at 35 than it did at 24. I do still like it, and I do still think it was... I think it deserves its reputation, and it I will say... At 35, with my personal, you know, life experience and some of the things that have happened, I kind of found this movie deeply hilarious this time.
I love that take.
It sort of smacks of melodrama in this way that I just devour. I'm like, oh my god, this is delicious. In a way that I think I was more actually unnerved by it when I was 24.
Yeah. Well, as maturity sets in, I think you can see. You could see more from like a third party or like looking through the glass of the melodrama. Whereas at maybe 24, you're like in the thick of it. You're like, I understand. I feel her. I feel bombs in my skin.
I was the Swan Queen when I was 24. Yeah. And watching it now at 35, I was like, this bitch is nuts.
Oh, shoot. Will turned into Barbara Hershey in 11 years. Oh, fuck.
I love that.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a big Natalie Portman fan. I go all the way back to like Beautiful Girls with her in 96. Mm-hmm. I've been on top of being one of the very few celebrity crushes I've had in my life, I think there's only really three. She's one of them.
for men of a certain, she was such a thing. Like, cause remember last year when that like stuff came out with her and Moby, and they, I remember some comedian on Twitter was like, they were like, listen, Moby, every dude from the 90s thinks they dated Natalie Portman at one point. Like,
well, so, but the age difference isn't that crazy. So there's only like a 3-year age difference, though. Beautiful Girl,
she's like a Lolita.
She's playing like a Lolita character, which I found disturbing, but I thought she did a great job of it. Mm-hmm. Around the same time, she did a turn in The Diary of Anne Frank, playing Anne Frank in New York on Broadway, in a play. And I saw it. I think I saw it when it was in previews. And I was blown away just by kind of her talent. And then obviously from there, she goes on to the Star Wars movies. And then her career really kind of takes off. So, I was just kind of like an early Natalie Portman fan of her work professionally. Plus, I think she's beautiful. I think she's very intelligent. I think she's got a smile that you only see once in this movie that is one of those kind of hypnotizing smiles, like that people always credit like Julia Roberts with having one of those like megawatt smiles. I think Julia Roberts' smile is actually kind of terrifying because she's got so much gum and teeth. But like Natalie Portman has got a smile, and she loses it in the when she's high with the Sebastian Stan. You get to see it. It's the only time you see it in this movie. But I'm like, yeah, that's it. That's all like right there. And it still hit me even at 42. It hit me. Yeah, I'm impressed by this performance. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot of psychological thriller stuff going on here, and I was here for, and I think she did a great job with it. Caroline, how about you? As our female voice, I'm expecting you not to be talking about Natalie Portman as a celebrity crush, but maybe, I don't know.
Not today, but yeah, she is just Queen Amidala to me, so I'm like, hey girl, what up? Like, different red lipstick, different day, but you're wearing it a little different today. But funny enough, Will, like, Mike accidentally got on with two dancers here, so I danced as well from like 8 to 13, and was on toe point, all that good stuff, and I saw my ballet slippers around here, and the scenes that resonated with me, that the blood, sweat, and tears part of it all, those nasty toe painful looking things going on, and sitting there, I can remember vividly, like, sitting on the steps, like, adjusting my shoes and working on, you know, exactly lacing everything up, and just everything, the whole thing was like, I remember these days.
They weirdly raise us with it, like in the dance world, where it's sort of like the macho man, like tough, like blah blah blah, where it's like you're like 7 or 8 years old taking ballet, and they're like the Fontaine danced into her 50s. I was like, yeah, I know, I heard that. And ballerinas have danced on broken ankles, and like, suck it up. And you're sort of like indoctrinated with that, even as like a child in the dance world. And like, ballerina feet are gnarly.
Very much so. And not only that, but like, there's this concept that they're like delicate and sweet and like whatever, like that part, the white swan, if you will. But the reality is, like, exactly what you're saying, like, they're actually tough as nails and are like out there doing stuff that A, you probably could never get your body to do. B, they're stronger than you can ever believe. My God, that scene when they were showing the older ballerina with her back and every move she was doing, I was like, oh my God, I was like sucked in looking at every little muscle in there. Amazing. There's so much more work to it. I actually lean more to being, well, I have to ask you, are you more of a Lily or a Nina? Because I'm more of a Lily in terms of like, I'm naturally strong. I'm naturally an athlete. So I brought that to the table, but I didn't give a shit about being perfect. So for me, it was like, I'm here and I'm doing it and I can do it because I'm just naturally doing it. But it wasn't that same sense of like, I'm going to do this because I practice 7,000 times a day. I'm going to come in and be like, I don't need to warm up. Let's just do this.
Yeah, 100%. I'm Lily. If it wasn't fun, I wasn't going to do it. And I won a high point. It was a competition, and it was like a high point score. So it was like above first place. I didn't understand at the time. I was just kind of like, ah, cool, my trophy's bigger. But I had done a move that was apparently there. I did like an inverted move, and it wasn't even in the routine. I just felt the spirit and did it. Nice. And then they tried to get me to do it again, and I'm like, I don't know what I did. I don't know how to do it.
See, you're like a total Lily. That's the same. Like, I'm there feeling the music and I'm doing this, but like, I'm not going to be someone who is like, you know, studying that some sort of manual to be perfection. Like, no, 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 no.
As a kid, if I wasn't immediately good at something, to hell with it. Like, I was just like, next. Like,
I love that. I love it. I love it. So, Mike, you got some weird co-hosts here that I bet you didn't expect you got.
I was much more of a Nina type. I was obsessive with music parts. I would stay well into the nighttime. You know, I ended up having like a set of keys to my high school in like my senior year. And like I was there like very late practicing parts and practicing my percussion parts and learning how to play 4 mallet parts, learning how to play 6 mallet parts. So I really identified with the obsessive compulsive aspect of the Nina character. It would not have been okay with me to be the blow it off Lily.
It's not blow it off. Yo, I'm going to stop you on that. As there's two Lilies on here. It's just like there's some part of it when it just comes naturally that you just kind of like do it. And then so then you almost don't even get the obsessiveness of the Ninas. You're like, why are you like making this so much harder than it is?
Right. When Thomas is comes over Nina's shoulder and they're both staring at Lily, he says, watch how she moves. It's imprecise, but it's effortless. She's not faking it. I got that. Like that resonated with me. And obviously that was him laying down. Thomas, in so many ways, is the narrator of this movie. He is like the signpost and guide that really put Nina on her path that she goes through this movie. Whatever the journey is that she's on, he's very much the guy pointing her in this direction and that direction. He comes in, every scene in the movie is really him kind of directing her, showing her what she needs to be doing, at least as far as he sees it. And I think that scene where he's talking about imprecise but effortless is a really important balance to being compulsive, to being able to do it all technically perfect. You need to also be able to feel it in your bones. But I was a patron of the arts. I used to be a subscriber to actually the Alvin Ailey dance troupe. So like I was like a season ticket holder for several years. So I love dance. I love dance movies, actually. In my notes, I called this movie Center Stage Had a Baby with Showgirls and the baby was Rosemary's Baby. Like that's very much like what this movie is for me in a lot of ways. So I was here for it. I was here for it. Let's actually start and talk though, because I think a lot of this movie is about control and it's about perfection and it's about what the cost of perfection and being the best is. There's this clip I'm going to play. There's several clips I'm going to play for you guys, but this is Thomas right after Beth has walked into traffic. Listen to this.
What happened?
She walked into the street and got hit by a car. And you know what? I'm almost sure she did it on purpose.
How do you know?
Because everything Beth does comes from within, from some dark impulse. I guess that's what makes it so thrilling to watch.
So dangerous.
Even perfect at times. But also so damn destructive.
Does that resonate as being true in dance or just in your guys' experience? The idea that you may have to push yourself into that red zone to achieve a certain level of success that you want. And maybe as Lilies, maybe that's not a way, that's not a path that you want to push yourself on. But is that something that you guys identify coming out of this world?
I'm going to say the Lilies of the world don't think about it. You just do it.
Yeah.
So I didn't think like, oh, I'm going down a path of destruction or I'm like leaning into this too hard. You don't even know you're leaning into it too hard and you're just doing it.
For a long time, I always thought of that this movie's about, like the whole like pursuit of perfection. I always thought of that as sort of like pretentious, like art speak. I was like, well, what is perfection and all that? And this is one of the movies that it maybe because I had a personal connection with like the art and the dance and the beauty of it all, but I understood what it was going for. And I think it landed in a way that didn't just sound like, you know, artistic mumbo jumbo, blah, blah, blah. But I am a bit of a perfectionist myself. And so it's like, yes, I'm always sort of chasing it, but I think it's ever elusive. Like for me, art isn't about achieving perfection. It quite literally is about giving it up before you drive yourself crazy. Like any art that I've ever created in my life has never lived up to my expectation. I just reach a point where I'm like, if I keep going, I'm going to ruin this. So now it's time to say goodbye and move on.
You know, Thomas sets upon him in his fresh take on the idea of the black of the Swan Lake. He's having the same dancer do the White Swan, the Swan Queen, and the Black Swan. And they are polar opposites. They are the light and dark of each other. And that's what Aronofsky is getting at in this film. I should say this movie was directed by Darren Aronofsky. And this is a thing with him. He likes duality. He likes, you know, dark nature, light nature kind of concepts. So is it even then possible to be able to dance the white swan, the swan queen character, which requires precision and perfection, perfection as adjudged by the greatest ballerinas and art directors and dance troupes of the world, and the black swan, which is more about seduction and feeling and letting go and less about precision? Are those things at odds? Can they ever be achieved? Because that's what she's trying to do here. She's trying to achieve both perfectly.
I mean, I actually think it's very possible, but I think it's impossible to assign to somebody. It's the kind of thing where it's like, if someone displayed the ability to do that, then absolutely cast them in this dual role. But to sort of come into it and be like, here's what I'm going to make you do, I don't think it works that way. And obviously, based on how the movie plays out, I don't think Nina was the one to do that. I don't think she's capable of it.
Well, that's the thing, though, right? Because I don't think he planned to have Nina. I mean, we know he didn't. And so she does the bite the lip moment, mm-hmm. right, with him, and shows that she does have a little bit of, I don't know what I want to call it, a little grit or a little something inside her that's a little more impulsive.
She got a little spice.
Yeah, a little impulsive, a little bit of like willing to go a little bit further, not just be the good girl, if you will, all the time, whatever you want to call that. But I almost think you have to have the precision first, because I mean, again, I almost feel like we're like the three bears here on this one, because for me, like, I think you're in the middle, Will, in terms of like, I think you probably absolutely would put in the work and work on being precise and also have like the sort of spirit and soulfulness behind it. Whereas like for myself, like I am not willing to put in the work. Like I'm truly not. Like I'm never going to care about being precise. My actual like motto in my house is done is perfect. So like if I've completed the task, it's fucking perfect. So that's how I leave it, because I don't have, my brain doesn't get into the minutiae of it. I think you almost have to start with the perfection and try to like get them into releasing themselves. Does that make sense? As opposed to going the other way.
Well, yeah. And I was actually going to say, if anything, Nina does it backwards. I think you need the black swan first and you can achieve the white swan. I don't think you can start from the white swan and get to the black swan.
Intrigue. Okay. I think it's really hard. I mean, I think that on both sides. I mean, I don't know, Mike, you're kind of the most of the three of us, the most white swan part of this. Do you think it's easier to let go, or do you think you should have been in a let go space and then kind of tighten up and be more precise?
Because you can work on technique.
Right. I think in a world where you don't want to end up stabbing yourself with a shard of glass in order to achieve your idea of perfection, I think you probably need to be the black swan first and then work up to the precision of the white swan. Because if you're geared towards, I make you bet Lily probably started dance later in life than Nina did, because she was probably drawn to the idea of dance, drawn to the feeling of it and not the technical precision.
She also probably started off not a ballerina.
Probably like not. She probably did modern or
general, right, or something.
Yeah, she probably did like modern or tap. Right.
So I have to tap. Get out of here. So I have to say, I actually think Mila
don't shit ball change me, motherfucker. I will put on my shoes.
I desperately want to learn how to tap dance.
Tap dance is fantastic. I used to bring in the noise and bring in defunk. That was me in the 90s.
Defunk, wow.
I think Mila Kunis is fantastic in this movie. For me, she's a huge bright spot, and I think necessary for the movie's success.
Absolutely necessary.
I think without her, this movie is miserable. But I do remember a review that was a little bit backhanded, and they were like, Mila Kunis is fine in it. It was like, she doesn't quite pull off ballerina as much as Laker Girl, but... I thought that was a little cutting. I was like, I
a little bit. I'm feeling that, because that when we talk about like who are you in this, and I say I'm more the Lily. I was also a cheerleader. I went directly from ballet to cheerleading, and guess what? Cheerleading fit me better. So like there, that yeah, I get the Laker girl. Mm-hmm, I get that.
I was gonna bring up a cheerleading comparison before, but I did it because I think cheerleading actually requires a lot of precision, and maybe it's maybe a more overall fun vibe, but that is a thing, much like David learns to his chagrin. If you don't have a good partner when you're holding them up above your head, shit's gonna go wrong in the middle of your performance. And I think cheerleading requires
it's like bridge. If you don't have a good partner, you gotta have a good hand.
Right.
And or sex. It's the same.
Well, sex is like pizza. Right. Even when it's horrible.
It's all good,
it's
right?
It's still pretty fucking good. even if you're by yourself. I think cheerleading is actually pretty precise, but I think there is a logical, I see that comparison. She's a Laker girl compared to ballerina. But, you know, I think I like Paula Abdul. Paula Abdul is fantastic. I mean, what straight kid, you know, in 89, 90, 91 wasn't jagging it to like Cold-Hearted Snake? God, I mean, I lost bodily fluids. I probably dehydrated myself watching that video as a kid. Hey, guys, this is...
Wasn't his name Cool Cat?
Oh, that was MC Scat Cat. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's a reason why she's on the stairs above him, because MC Scat Cat's trying to look up her like little skirt there. But oh no, Cold Heart Snake's the one where the dancers it becomes, they're on like a set, like it's like a all scaffolding and stuff in like a warehouse, and they pull the shades down. It's like oh yeah. Oof. Anyway. What was I saying? But she was a Laker girl. That was my point, was that, I mean, Paula Abdul was a Laker girl, and she went on to be the very popular, very in-demand choreographer, and which is all about precision. And I think it goes both ways. I think, though, if you are wired to be the A-type personality, prima ballerina, white swan, it's hard to dial that back, though, to be the black swan, though, the way the movie sets up what's required for both.
But it's also the X factor. I mean, you just sort of explained it right there, where it's like, many people can learn the technique and can come at something from such a technically proficient place. But if they're not thrilling, I mean, to say the phrase, the X factor again, it's like we have all of these shows and stuff, and there's singing competitions and dancing competitions, and there's so many people that, you know, are so technically talented. But if they're not dynamic, it's sort of like meh. Yeah. And I mean, look at someone like Britney Spears. It's like, she's of her peers, she is not the most technically vocally accomplished, but she was the one I wanted to watch.
Yeah. I love the line when he was saying seduce the audience and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that's the part where, you know, the Lilies of the World got it. Like, we know what to do. We got you. But, you know, but also just don't pay that much attention to my feet. It might not be perfect.
Well, that's a nice segue, though, because he's a gross guy, right? He's predictably gross. Remember, and this is 2010, so this is well before the Me Too movement and stuff.
I wanted to talk about this.
Yeah, so, but that being said, he also makes good points. And so I wanted to play it to perfection, because he has a great line here about perfection is not just about control. And I think that kind of goes into... it goes into his whole shtick about you have to seduce the audience. You have to, you know, that she's effortless but imprecise. He's trying to tell her there's more to perfection the way he determines it, and he's the one in charge here. So perfection is his definition here. But it's more than just about being control and always hitting every movement correctly, having your feet in the right position every single movement. It's this clip right here.
Well, the truth is, when I look at you, all I see is the white swan. Yes, you're beautiful, fearful, fragile. Ideal casting. But the black swan, it's a hard fucking job to dance both.
I can dance the black swan too.
Really? In 4 years, every time you dance, I see you obsessed getting each and every move perfectly right, but I never see you lose yourself. Ever. All that discipline for what?
Just want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Perfection is not just about control. It's also about letting go. Surprise yourself so you can surprise the audience. Transcendence. And very few have it in them.
Right? The seduction of the audience, the transcendence, the surprise yourself so you can surprise the audience. I love that line. But then he sucks on her face like a gross motherfucker. And, you know.
Well, let's get into that. Will, give us your opinions on this.
How old is she supposed to be? Do we know?
Early 20s is my guess.
Okay. Because I think he bit off more than he could chew with her. I think, like, obviously, March of 2021, we are very much in a post-Me Too. Like, all of the stuff I'm watching, I'm like, yeah, no, you can't do that. And I think that's good. And I think that's necessary. There's always sort of, in my opinion, been a little bit of a blurred line when dealing with, like, art and especially passion-based stuff. And I do think that their specific relationship to points, I mean, not through the entire movie, but to points, it, at least for me, it was not coming across as a, you know, boss necessarily abusing his employee. Because I think, and especially early on, you know, he gives her outs. It's like, if this is more than what she's bargained for, then she can bow out of this. Although, I mean, it is a promotion because it is a job. So I found it to be very kind of like Lee. But also, I kind of think for the most part, he's right. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, do this stuff. And it obviously the big conversation is with, like, is with consent. It's that she can't be doing this because she thinks she has to, because she thinks he requires it of her. But if they are in a, like, mutual place, then,
because she comes to him like she's coming to the casting couch, right? She's uh-huh. wearing the stolen lipstick, right? Like, she's yeah. never put on lipstick before. Like, I mean, like, she looks like Ace Ventura when he's putting on the tutu, the way she's wearing the, because, like, she's coming him to meekly, like, I'm going to submit to you to get this, but, like, I understand, like, this is what you want. And I don't think that's actually what he's looking for. I think he kisses her to get a rise out of her, because I think he strikes me as someone who's much more going to go try and bone the Lily than the Nina. Mm-hmm.
It's a lot easier to get the Lily than the Nina.
But I think it's because I mean he's got to be thinking, you know, she's so clenched up. What, you know, what is he even going to do with her? Kind of thing. I don't get a real sexual attraction to her from him. I think the things, like, where he kisses her here, when he grabs her, you know, her tits, and he's grinding on her, and then he kisses her, and then he pulls away, and he was just fucking with her, and he says, mm-hmm. you know, I seduced you, and you need to be able to seduce me.
Well, because sex is one of his most valuable assets.
Uh-huh. Yes. I mean, and talking about it, Vincent Cassel, he said that he was going for a Balanchine feel, that who was a very famous dancer who then became a very famous director of the New York Ballet. He, you know, had a real sexuality about him, a real machismo, and he used that to motivate his dancers, for good or bad. It was a tool and a weapon. You know, he weaponized his sexuality and by extension sexualized his dancers to get stuff out of them. Carol, is that acceptable? Is that acceptable ever? Is that acceptable in 2021?
Lord, that is a tough question. I mean, let me say it like this. Okay, so I've been in a lot of different sports, and I've played many different sports, and I can say that coaches in general, which I'm going to consider him that in my brain, absolutely say things and do things that push the boundaries always to get the best performance out of their athletes. Lots of stuff has been yelled at me. Nobody's ever touched my body. Like, that's kind of where I feel like, okay, I've never had it go like that. For me, I mean, a lot of things have been yelled at me to get me to do certain things and to amp me up or piss me off or whatever. But, and so manipulated, yeah, I think coaches manipulate athletes all the time. I think, of course, this is, for me, yeah, it's crossing the line. I mean, I know that when you said she's put on the lipstick and it's like she's never put on lipstick before, I was wanting to bust in on that, because, like, as a lifelong, like, dancer and performer, she would have always worn mm-hmm. various makeup and lipstick, right? But, I mean, she put that on, you're right, in that moment, she put it on as something more than that, as, like her sort of half-hearted attempt at seducing him, I think. But she didn't commit to that or anything, you know?
I think it's the difference between getting yourself made up to become a performer and go on stage versus we see her go out with Lily. Until she gets high, she has no game. Like, she's a total lame-o, you know? I mean, she's hanging out with Tom yes. and Jerry and Lily, and she is just like Squaresville. But and I think as she comes to him in this office, it's the same way. It's this very kind of pathetic. It's a woman who doesn't understand her sexuality at all, which is another big part of what this movie is about. On top of Perfection and Control, it's about, yeah. you know, yeah. do you know your body?
There's a story from Lady Gaga's Bad Romance music video where she was in a consensual working situation and environment with her director, Jonas Åkerlund. And they trusted each other. They had each other sort of like they had the meeting. They went through all the motions, and he gets a performance out of her from a very volatile place. They had a close set. He was sort of like screaming at her, like she agreed to allow this to happen. And it was an exceptional performance. And so in that's sort of what I'm addressing it from, where I'm like, if the people, and we don't see it in this movie, and I think if this movie were made now, we would. But it's like, I think if these dancers understood and are sort of agreeing at the beginning that it's like, yes, I understand that you're going to push my boundaries, and I am okay with that. I consent to that. And then if I feel like a line has been crossed, we'll have to reevaluate. Like, that's what I was sort of getting at, where right. It's like this movie, they just sort of go for it in ways that I mean, it makes for a less thrilling movie, but he needed to be like, do you mind if I push you? Like,
right. The trope doesn't work that way though, then, right?
Yeah. And I was going to say, like, don't you feel like it's a little bit like, you know, any activity that you get into when you're young, and it's sort of like this slow grooming process where, like, you never consented to be yelled at. You never consented to be whatever. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the level that she would be at, I mean, it's just a given. And so you sort of like passively consented along the way.
Your parents consented on your behalf is what it actually usually is.
Yeah.
I mean, I taught Taekwondo for a long time, and I taught competitive Taekwondo. And I mean, it's a sport where you put on some padding, but you basically are teaching kids how to beat the shit out of each other. Parents consented on behalf of their kids. A lot of these kids didn't consent to the stuff that we would put them through, and mm-hmm. and having to scream at them and having to drive them and push them and get them to have a violence about them that maybe they didn't have naturally, but it was a contact sport. It was competitive. It was what was required, or else they would have gotten hurt if they didn't. You have to kind of use the tools available to push them to get them there. You know, and again, I don't think this is okay. I don't think this is consent. But if he had made them all sign forms, though, at the beginning of the season, and says, you consent that I may kiss you, I may yell at you, I may grab your tits often, you know, my penis, you may feel it in your backside.
Oh my God.
You sign here, please. And what dancers could be like, yes, I accept that those are things that may happen for you to get the best performance. No, it would be completely deflated, right? It's like, if it's hiccups don't get cured if you know the scare is coming. It's all kind of part of the same thing.
Well, and have any of us been in the position, because I know I have, and I know you have, Mike, so I think you probably have, where you're trying to coach someone else to do something, and it's not like you even, I'll take Tomas's side for a moment and say, perhaps he wasn't planning on going that way, but mm-hmm. he's like just struggling to get through to her, to motivate her, to whatever, and this is not an apology for his behavior, because it is wrong. And at the same time, like, you could say that he didn't sign a form either that said, I'm going to kiss you, I'm going to grab your tits, I'm going to do whatever. Like, he was just like,
in the moment.
Yeah. And it's kind of gross and weird to say it like that, but he was just like pushing. He was like trying so hard to break through. If she had broken and figured it out when he was just talking to her, he wouldn't have gone there. No. He only went there because she never broke, I guess, is that, you know?
And there's also an element for me where it's like, I actually am a big fan of Vincent Castle. So it's like, I'm watching this two layers removed, where anytime these scenes are happening, I'm like, I should be so lucky, you know?
Right.
I'm sort of desiring it. So it's like, it's hard for me to look at it objectively.
I'd bite you, Vincent.
Well, and you know, Will, I mean, also, like, the amount of time that they would have spent with him, I mean, the amount of crushes that were probably on him, just because he's the only man these girls probably see because they're there for so many hours.
Let alone heterosexual, yeah.
Exactly.
But you're right, that does add to the ickiness, and the movie only touches on the culture, which can be quite toxic, as evidenced by, was her name, like, Veronica? The mm-hmm. other...
Ugh, I think it's Veronica. Little Swan. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Little Swan.
And I can see how it's like having to compete with that would push someone out of their comfort zone. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Well, yeah. I mean, I mentioned it before, and I said it a little bit jokingly as when I was giving my one summary description of this movie. But that's something that the movie Center Stage actually does very well. Mm-hmm. Center Stage really gets into, and if you guys haven't seen Center Stage, you should go watch it.
I have, but it's been years. Is it good? Like, is it still good? I remember it being good when I was a teenager.
I haven't watched it. I feel like I watched it like 4 or 5 years ago, I came across it and I watched it, and I remember still liking it. It's silly. It's a CW like movie about dance culture at a pretend ballet company in New York. But clearly, they're talking about ballet culture though, and it's a lot of the same tropes we're seeing here. There's the girl who is precise. You know, she was born in point shoes. You know, and she has to go to like a modern like hip hop dance class, and she's like, I don't know how to do this kind of thing, you know, and it's all about that. And, you know, it's like, if you were a little looser, well, if you were a little more precise, and we all just became this great dancer. And there's a gross ballet director who becomes obsessed with the girl he picks. And
so yeah, it's Cooper.
Cooper is the boy dancer.
Okay.
It's eyebrows, OC guy eyebrows. What's his name? Peter Gallagher, eyebrows. Yeah. He's the gross like ballet director there. He's the, you know, the Thomas in that movie. But it touches upon the cattiness of the culture though. It is toxic because by definition, there's a core. And then there's a soloist. And so you have all these who have spent their lives doing this to only always be in the core and not get the solo part when they think they're entitled. It's a very toxic thing. And the movie does a good job of kind of demonstrating that. It's a silly movie, but it's worth watching because it touches on these things. And it has a great final dance number. It involves a motorcycle on the stage. So good. So good. And she's got that fantastic red dress.
Braided red hair. Yeah.
Oh, anyway. Yeah, and it's got Zoe Saldana in an early role of hers. So there you go. Go for it. She's the tight ass like ballerina is Zoe Saldana.
I love that you added in our notes, Mike, that the first script was called The Understudy, about an off-Broadway actor and being haunted by a double. The concept of that never really sunk in until I just read that on my notes here. That would mess with you. Somebody who's kind of like your doppelganger, you know, who badly wants you to just be dead so that they can have your part.
Have you ever seen Enemy?
No. No.
Jake Gyllenhaal and Denis Villeneuve, however you say his name, French sure. name.
Villeneuve?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I recommend it. I have a hard time being like, it's excellent, but I didn't regret seeing it. And it's about that. It's about he sees his doppelganger in a movie and becomes obsessed with finding who this person is.
That's amazing.
There's weird imagery with spiders
maybe we should talk about let's talk about actually how this movie came to be though, because that was something normally we would talk about at the beginning and we kind of jumped right into the meat of the story. But Darren Aronofsky actually originally approaches Natalie Portman about doing a ballet movie in 2000. Long time ago. It was right after Requiem for a Dream came out. He approaches Natalie Portman and says, listen, I'm thinking about this ballet movie I want to do. Why ballet? Because his sister grew up training as a ballerina at the Performing Arts High School in New York. So he had grown up kind of around the ballet culture and was fascinated by it. In 2000, at the same time he's thinking about ballet, he comes across this script from Andre Hines called The Understudy. And it's what Caroline said. It's an unproduced script about off-Broadway actors. And there's also this doppelganger concept in there. He likes the idea. He wants to make it relate to ballet though. At the same time, he comes out with The Wrestler, the Mickey Rourke film from a couple years ago, and his original idea for that was that there was going to be a wrestler and a ballerina and both of their lives get followed. But then he realized that that's too much story, because he liked the idea of wrestling as this low art and ballet as this high art concept. But at the way, they're both physically demanding. Like, people, you know, shit on wrestling, but it is physically demanding to do. And so he liked that idea, so he takes the understudy script. He has John McLaughlin rewrite it. John McLaughlin takes the understudy script. It turns into Black Swan. He puts it in the Swan Lake concept. The movie like stalls again. It gets revived again when Universal shows some interest in it. And he has Mark Heyman rewrite the script. And that's the final screenplay, is what this movie is. He was able to sell it. Universal eventually puts it into turnaround. And, you know, they walk away from it. And so a couple of independent production companies pick it up, and Fox Searchlight distributes it. They are the one who give the production budget for it. They give them like $12-13 million to make the movie. The selling point was you had Natalie Portman for 10 years attached to this project because she was into it. Natalie Portman, coming out of Star Wars, coming out of all these roles where she played this like Queen Amidala, these what she thought of like as little kid roles. She was looking to do something more adult. And this was that's one of the things that really attracted her to this role, was that it was such a big departure, because she had felt pigeonholed, that people were only typecasting her because she's tiny, she has kind of a higher pitched voice, and so she was looking to kind of break out of that, do something more mature. So it was kind of this perfect start, but this movie is literally 10 years in the making, driven by this concept of the haunted doppelganger, but also the ballet culture aspect that he wanted to bring all together.
Did you guys feel like her voice was like oddly high and babyish in this one? Is it just me? Or am I only just knowing her as royalty, Queen Amidala, and so I don't know her.
She does speak in a monotone as Queen Amidala, but...
Yeah, she sure does. But, I mean, when she was like, what happened to her? I was like, what the fuck is that voice coming out of her? Because she barely talks in this.
Well, there's actually a fun trivia a bit about that in IMDb, and actually, if you watch this on Amazon, most of IMDb's trivia for this movie comes from the Amazon X-Ray trivia. It's just copied over. There's a great quote that she had spent years trying to lower her voice, going to, like, all these vocal coaches, trying to lower her voice because she's so tiny and petite looking, and she had a naturally kind of high youngish voice. She spent years lowering her voice with vocal coaches. This movie, she had to like break all of that training. And so there's a quote in the trivia, I can't remember what it is, but basically she says, other than the intensive training she did in ballet to prepare for this role, the hardest aspect of making this movie was getting her voice to be high pitched again. To play kind of the demented, you know, arrested development Nina that we have. Because no woman with a deep voice is going to have that fucking bedroom that she's living in. That thing was disturbing.
So the scene in the beginning of the movie, when she sits down with the grapefruit, it's like almost like shudder inducing, where she's like, pretty. And it's just like, ugh.
Yes.
And I'm at a place where it's like, I've known a Nina or two in my life. And I'm like, oof. Run. Like,
yeah. And same with the cake scene when, I mean, or the fact that she calls her mother mommy, like all of those things, like barf me out. Like
I have in my notes in capital letters, mommy, he picked me mommy. I have in capital letters, yikes, yeah, across the heading of my page. I have in my notes, I have signs of Nina's descent into madness. Her room, I think, is on here a couple times. And like, I mean, like the infantile, what grown woman goes to sleep with a music box that plays Dance of the Swans? What the actual fuck is happening here?
And speaking of Darren Aronofsky, it's like one of my favorite little anecdotes ever, but I was listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Linda Holmes told it, where it was 2 or 3 years ago when Phantom Thread was doing the award circuits, and I guess Jennifer Lawrence said in an interview that she like sat down to watch Phantom Thread, and she made it like 3 minutes into the movie, and she was like, woof, not for me. I have lived this. I do not need to. I know where this story is going, you know? And it's like, I had a similar thing watching this at like 35, where I was like, oh, this is and I think that's part of why I was sort of coping with humor, where I was like, there are certain parts where watching it now as adult where I'm like, this is just kind of hilarious. But
let's talk about sexuality, because we're talking about the bedroom, and you can't think of the bedroom in this movie without thinking of that masturbation scene where she's wearing like her little panties, and she's rolling over, and she's taking Tomas's
she's just wearing regular panties, but yes.
Well, but they're like
childish panties.
They're childish panties. That was what I'm saying. They're just like basic. They're not sexy, right? There's nothing sexy about her at this point in the movie. That was my point. And so Tomas has said, go home and touch yourself. Crazy. Will, I don't know what it is about you and me getting on podcasts together, but this is the second time a man has told a woman to go home and touch herself. I don't like this trend. I don't know why this is a thing.
But both times it was necessary.
Well, and I'll even throw out there that I've never been told to go home and touch myself. So I don't know what this universal movement is to encourage touching yourself. It hasn't really been catching on, I would say.
Yeah, it's a real man position, a mansplaining position in Hollywood, that there's a trend where men have to instruct women to go home and masturbate. Like, we give you permission. You need to go get,
yes,
you know, associated with your
we
vagina.
We know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, I mean, honestly, one of the really legitimate jump scares, this is definitely psychological thriller, psychological horror, but there's not a lot of, like, gore, and there's not a lot of horror here. I jumped when she rolls over and sees her mother passed out in the chair.
It's shocking.
I was more startled than Nina was. Like, I was like, oh my God. Like, she was embarrassed. I was like running out of the room.
Yeah, it is shocking, like mortifying, the violation that I felt. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes. I'm like,
I felt more than she did, you know? Yeah. Like, Nina like rolled back over and kind of was like, oh God. I was like, oh God. And also, oh my God. Like, I was like freaking out. I would die. You guys, I would die. You wouldn't even see me. I would just evaporate right into the thin air.
So what is the dynamic with her? Like, is her mother as... Because I think Nina's an unreliable narrator. Duh. So, like, yes, is her mother as crazy as she is?
I'm going to say yes.
Oh, I think she's crazy, but I think they're doing a subtle or more nuanced version of the stage mom trope. The idea that Barbara Hershey's character never got out of the core. And so through her daughter is trying to achieve kind of that stardom. And that's like what the cake scene is, right? And it's not just trope. It's real life for athletes, often for musicians, for dancers. This is a thing you see with parents a lot, where it's all or nothing, right? If she doesn't want to have a giant piece of the fucking cake, well, then it's garbage. She's just going to put the whole thing in there in the trash to kind of control her because she knows then that, you know, Nina's a good girl and she's going to then take the finger lick of icing off of her finger. Nina looks like she wants to barf.
Holy shit, though. If my mother put her finger out, there is nothing you could possibly do that would make me suck off her finger.
You would
nothing.
Bite your mom's
I mean,
finger before
I
anything
would.
Else.
I have a great relationship with my mom, but we are not... Like, I would never do something like that. I was like, right. I'd be like, put your fucking finger away. What is this?
So I guess my initial question, I was going to say, I shouldn't say crazy. That's reductive. But I was going to be like, my initial question was, like, has her mother actually been helping her to this point? Or is her mother making this situation worse? And I feel like we're in agreement that it's worse.
Worse.
Absolutely.
Worse. And
I
mean, for me, it's perfectly demonstrated when she pulls down and she sees Nina's back for the first time, which Nina has been trying to hide. Her concern is not, oh my God, my daughter has begun picking her back again, you know, which is a compulsive disorder. It's, oh my God, you have a fitting to go to. They're going to see your bloody back. Like, that tells you everything you need to know about what this relationship is, together with the infantilization of her daughter, right?
There's God, telling her to take her shirt off at that one point so that she could see her back and everything. I was like, holy shit.
Yes, but I'm thinking even of when she tucks her in, again, I mean, you're still tucking your daughter in her 20s. You're putting her music box on for her. You allow her to live in this room that looks like it's not been changed since she was 7. You know, all of that Arrested Development, it's this my baby kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of what Nina goes through in this movie that I'm happy for her. I know it's destructive and I know it's damaging, but there is something very freeing about.
And it doesn't end well.
It doesn't end well, but it kind of ends well, though. There's a point of view where she achieves her goal. She is free. She has become what she wanted to be. But it's this scene that really makes me like fist pump because I dislike the mom in this so much. It's this scene right here.
Move.
Nina.
Move!
What happened to my sweet girl, huh? She's gone!
Oh, Nina! Nina! No, please! You're not well!
Let go of me!
I can't handle this!
I can't! I'm the Swan Queen! You're the one who never left the core!
I mean, that comes like about 20 minutes before the end of the movie.
So, yeah, so good. Also, it kicked off a trend of me screaming, I'm the Squan Queen at people.
For sure. For sure.
I love that. You're like making your cereal. They're like, well, what are you doing? Like, I'm the Squan Queen.
Yeah. Oh, no. I was insufferable for a full year.
I love it.
This is a safe space, so I can tell you guys, I've told my cat 3 times in the last week that I'm the Swan Queen. when I feel that she's trying to assert dominance over me.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
It's a Barbara Hershey special. She played a similar role. Not quite similar, but on Once Upon a Time, did we...
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Subject ourselves to that.
Very, very similar, very, very similar. Yes. Yeah, so I think so much of her sexuality and this exploration of herself is all tied into this relationship with her mother. When she comes home after she's been out, and she comes home with Lily right before their sex scene, and the mother is like, "Where have you been?" She's like, "I fucked the two guys," you know, like that whole thing. That's like the worst thing. That's like one of the worst things that she could have done. Not again, not "Are you safe?" Not "You could have gotten yourself hurt." Mm-hmm. None of that. That's not the concern. The concern is you're almost like she's dirty now. Mm-hmm. You know, that all of that Puritan bullshit. "I want my baby forever." It's very Norman Bates. I, you know, Caroline, you just did Psycho for March Madness. It's very Norman Bates and his mother kind of relationship.
Yeah. And actually, they have similar bedrooms in terms of like all of his stuff was like little boy stuff in his bedroom.
It's that it's a Arrested Development thing. It's we just don't never see being that able to
dynamic with women as much.
No,
yeah,
no.
You're probably right. Like, there's a lot of mama's boy, not so much mama's girl. So,
yeah, which is just interesting.
And it's interesting that there is no dad in here, right? So that's
also... Well, because it puts the Thomas relationship in even weirder.
Right, but also, like, makes it also feel more real. Like, you believe it more that this guy is this weird pseudo-sexual object of desire for her, but also, like, a father figure to her, too.
Given these three people, giving, you know, her mother, Lily and Thomas, I'm like, go with Lily and Thomas, you know? I would have loved a feel-good movie where her and Lily just become friends. You know what I mean? Because you also, by the end, you're wondering how much of this is actually real and how much of it she just imagined, you know, with her dynamic, her relationship with Lily.
100%. When Mike just said, and Lily came home with her and all that stuff, I was like, did she, though? Did she come home with her? Like, I don't know if Lily came home with her. I think she did not. So I don't know about all that.
Well, can we go then through the signs of madness? Because I think it's a really interesting exploration. The movie really builds on it as it goes through in a lot of different subtle ways. You have established condition things that she has, right? She's got her eating disorder. She's got her skin picking compulsions. Those aren't part of the descent into madness. They're just, I mean, when people feel pressure, those things manifest if you're inclined to have those things. So I don't really include that into the descent into madness. But the coveting Beth McIntyre, the Winona Ryder character, going into her dressing room and stealing her lipstick and the nail file and all the other shit. It's very Tom Riddle in the orphanage kind of thing, you know, taking little treasures and trophies. The idea that she wants to see herself as the new Beth. The first thing that really made me have pause in the movie is when she sees "whore" written on the bathroom mirror. I don't think that was really there. Did that strike you as something that was maybe imagined at any point? Or am I wrong? And that's definitely something that was written there.
I think it's 50-50.
I think so, too. But I was actually leaning more to it probably was there. Because that would have been right when the, you know.
Veronica.
Yeah. And everything was like, you know, they just put up the cast list. And then, you know, and probably someone could hear her whispering in the freaking bathroom. That wasn't actually a very secretive place.
But no, I agree. It could have been.
But it could have been, yeah.
How quickly, though, that would have had to happen, though. She wasn't on the phone terribly long. You know, someone had lipstick on them, was like, "I'm going to go write horror on the mirror," because she's in a bathroom stall talking. It all happened very quickly. And I think the way the paranoia manifests itself in this and the imagined things that prove themselves to be imagined manifest themselves, this seemed very much as an early sign of it that's just not obvious.
You know what's funny about that, though, when you just said that? Like, someone would have had to know and would have had to have their lipstick. I'm thinking... There's plenty of girls who had their lipstick on them because it didn't matter who was picked. If it wasn't them, they were writing "whore" on the mirror. It didn't matter. Like, it wasn't directed really at her. It was just like, it's not me. I'm writing "whore" on the mirror.
It was like, a pre-planned, you know, trick mirror. They're like, this is going to come in handy either way.
Kind of. Like, I'm going to act out in some way here when this happens. Yeah. So I'm very 50-50 on that one because I think we should go through and be like, you know, which side do we lean on here? Like, which side was it? Because that one, I think, maybe.
What part of this was, because I actually disagree with you. I don't think it was a pre-planned thing, because remember how it would have looked optically. I don't think it's anyone is getting that. If it was real, you have this girl who is getting dogged for not letting go in rehearsals. Everyone sees it. Everyone knows what her problem is. She's precise. She's a great white swan. He says out loud, "If it was only to make you the white swan, you know, but can you dance the black swan?" But she goes into his office. She's all dolled up. She goes into his office. She comes out. The cast list goes up. And out of nowhere, she's been cast as the swan queen. Now, so someone was ready for that, I think, specifically for Nina. Look at that. She just came out of the casting couch kind of thing. Or it's Nina's own psychology that she's thinking that about herself because she went in to the office willing to do what was necessary, however that played out, in order to get the role. So that mirror, and again, the mirror is also reflecting yourself in this movie a lot, seemed like a way of her own psychology.
I agree with you. I think it's purposefully open for interpretation.
I think so, too, because I honestly think that it is not outside the realm of possibility that the other ballerinas did write something on there. You know,
because you do hear a slight scuffle when she's in. I listened when she's in the stall. So it's like,
because she kind of pauses and looks, right? She kind of like doesn't look, but she kind of looks to the side. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a well-made movie. There's like a, you know, but no, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's entirely possible that that's in her head.
Then we have a couple things that I think are pretty definitively imaginary, but they're interesting because of how they begin to progress. She sees her cuticle is bleeding, right? So she starts to pick at it, which I think a lot of people pick at their nails and maybe pull the skin too much and cause bleeding. God knows I do. But then she like slices off, like she's like, you know, Buffalo Bill from like Silence of the Lambs. Like she slices off like a whole thing of her skin of her finger, but then she looks at her finger and it's not there. Right. Like, like it's actually not been ripped off. But then she has the bathtub scene, another time that she tries to, you know, masturbate and it gets aborted, you know. And so then she sinks herself below the water and then she sees, is it herself? I think it's herself, not Lily, above her. And she's bleeding. You know, what is that about? What is going on in the bathtub scene there? What do we think that's trying to demonstrate, that she sees the bleeding version of herself like above her in the water?
I have nothing to back this up, but I felt like there was a connection with the fact that she was just attempting to masturbate. And I mean, if she's got sex hangups, I thought there was a connection there.
You know, I don't know. It's kind of like that side of you that's like gets angry at yourself and is sort of like, get the fuck together. Like I kind of it was like an out of body experience kind of thing where she was looking back at herself and wanting to just be like, God damn it. You know, come on.
That's a legitimate kind of horror moment, right? That almost felt like it was kind of like out of the ring.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a swan tile like just behind her, the left side of her head in the bathtub. In this white tile bathtub, there's a swan tile there, which I thought was just really smart, good set dressing to have that there. Because again, and it was the white
so
swan.
Subtle. Yeah. So freaky.
So subtle. And you would easily miss it. But this idea, you know, this virginal aspect of her is coming under assault. It's coming under assault in her own mind. It's coming under assault by Thomas. It's coming under assault by Lily. You know, all of these forces are attacking this white virginal aspect of herself.
You know, something that I caught that really like unnerved me is when she finds her mother's paintings, which first of all, that's an entirely different thing, but
why paint one creepy head when you can paint 19,000 of them?
Well, that's where I was going to when you asked if she was, you know, had madness in herself. To me, yeah, she was a tortured artist in her own way. So those paintings, my God, they reminded me of Etchimono, though. If you remember old Etchimono. And if you don't, go look it up because you'll laugh.
It's gonna be one of those things where I have to clear my Google browser.
Etchimono. No, but it'll make you laugh.
Is this the woman that was fixing the church? Yes. Okay. The Kate McKinnon character. Yeah.
Yes.
No, what I was gonna say is that one of the pictures moves well before that scene later where they all are like mocking her. One of them, the eye line changes like earlier on in the movie when she's looking for her mom.
I love that. I think there's a bunch of little Easter eggy things like that in this movie. One of them is, and it happens earlier on, she sees herself on the face of the woman dressed in black. Again, and we could talk about color in a second here. We should. She passes in the alley. She passes that woman dressed in black. And then as she gets closer, she sees that it has her own face.
Well, is that person even there? Because initially that person is mirroring her,
right?
Her actions, like taking the cell phone out and closing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, is that person really there, though? Because then you later on, well, we could jump into after Lily and Nina have sex or don't.
Wait, we all agree don't, right? I just want to be clear. Like, she's not there, and this is just a fantasy, right?
Right. I think fantasy, but I think she probably, based on the destruction of the
room,
it was real to her. I mean,
hey, man, whatever gets you through the night, I'm fine with that. But, you know, wow.
But Lily turning into Nina and then smothering herself?
Yeah.
I mean, she finally has allowed herself to orgasm, which is a great milestone, but she's rewarded in her own psyche. Well, it is, but she's rewarded in her own brain.
Every little girl's milestone chart. You go fill out in the baby book, first orgasm. It was fantastic.
You know, but then she gets smothered by a pillow. It's like escalating. Like, the more she escalates discovering her own sexuality, the more the violence against her own self increases.
So do you guys feel that, though, like on that theme of, like, you know, your grown self kind of killing your young self? Do you guys feel that? Like, do you like, forget ballet, forget everything else, but that sense of, like, once you start getting into, like, more adult stuff, you kind of are smothering your little innocent little kid self? I kept my childlike wonder, so I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting in our office and I'm surrounded by actual dolls and action figures. but I was going to say, I mean, my story is slightly different, as we touched on a little bit in the Happiest Season, but it was like, I had a lot of that, but it was external. It was like guilt that was being imposed on me, sociopolitically stuff. Okay. I think if I were just allowed to sort of come of age on my own, I was very excited to move on to the next step. I didn't have, with the exception of, like I said, the external conflict, I didn't have that conflict. I if anything, I kind of felt like, have you ever seen the SNL The Wells for Boys skit?
I haven't, no.
Oh my god, it's so good. I'll send it to you guys. But I sort of feel like that I was sort of waiting to become an adult. You know what I mean?
Interesting, like, though, because I feel like I was pressured to stay a kid, though, as well. But from that virginal girl standpoint, like, I'm not supposed to look sexual. I'm not supposed to look anything for a really long time. Like, there was like a weird long time for me before, like, my parents would be okay with that. Are you laughing over there?
No.
Shut up.
But
like, just totally that idea of, like, you know, needing to not be overly sexual or stuff. Like, I feel like that was imposed on me as well. So there's a lot of weird elements of, like, becoming a sexual person, I guess.
There is. And I want to go back to something you said, though, because I think it's an important distinction, and I think it's an important nuance that the movie is talking about. And I don't want to just gloss over it. You said, but I've kept my childlike wonder. That's not the kind of, you know, I have in my notes here, you know, Kylo Ren from Star Wars. There's this great quote where he says, you know, you have to let the past die, kill it if you have to. Nina's on that journey, but it's not the childlike wonder necessarily. No one's saying you have to stop having that. Like, you could still watch cartoons and get a kick out of it. It's the infantilization aspect. It's the baby bed. It's mm-hmm. There's a reason why she throws all of her bedding down the trash chute. There's a reason why she breaks her mom's finger and she yells, "I'm the Swan Queen." All of that is part of killing that part of her virginal youth, physically and emotionally and psychologically rebelling and killing, smothering that aspect of her, so that she become a woman in a sexual being kind of way.
Well, and the Black Swan. I mean, because there is, like,
right. I think the Black Swan is you couldn't be a sexual. You couldn't be the Black Swan if you did not become a mature sexual being.
Well, I was going to say, yes, there's the femininity, absolutely, but it's also like the sort of very pristine nature where it's like she wants a little bit of, like, chaos.
Yeah.
Well, so I, in my brain, though, I guess I separate out, and maybe you guys don't. I don't know. There's one feeling of, like, growing up and getting past, like, that baby bed and the stuffed animals and all that kind of stuff. But I actually don't, I guess this is my own just life experience, I don't link that to sexual side of things. Like, I don't, that they're different to me. Like, wanting to put my stuffed animals away is not because I want a dick. You know what I mean? Like, they're not linked. Like, I wanted to be grown and sophisticated, and that isn't the same thing as her masturbating for me.
But I think that's because you had a more healthy upbringing, though, where your parents weren't enforcing that upon you. I think for Nina, I think they are linked, though. I think she has been inhibited. She's being kept in this cocoon of being a little girl, which has which has stalled her development across the way. I think the sexuality is just one aspect of it, but I think they are linked for her. I don't think she could become.
Can we also throw in from the dance side that the age part is actually a really big fucking deal? So, like, the idea of her not growing up, that also has to do with she can't age because then you, like, age out, if you will. So if she hasn't achieved success by a certain point, she's out of the game.
Right. She's so Beth. She becomes Beth or her mother.
You've got to stay little and young for as long as you can.
Well, there was something that I wanted to say, and I was like, between the three of us, it's like we're also comparing male sexuality and female sexuality, where it's like male sexuality, especially young men, it's assumed that it's there and we just don't address it. Where female sexuality, we assume it's not there and also we check to make sure. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. You
know,
yeah.
So
I don't want nobody to check to make sure.
Right. Well, culturally, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, right. No one was ever doing wet dream checks for guys, but hymen checks were being done, like are still being done in parts of the world, you know? Like that's a thing. And that's
so
disgusting.
I think that accounts for some of the difference, but
yeah, you all make good points. Good points.
Well, but I think it's part of the thing that makes her so sympathetic, such a sympathetic character, and why I'm happy for her journey in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd rather her not die, but in some ways, I'd rather her die having become what she achieves at the end versus living a life where she's living with her mother in that room and having all of those issues.
Well, so what lens are we looking at this from? From a modern health and happiness place, this is a tragedy. From, like, I don't know, a Greek place, you know, you could consider this a victory.
Right. You know, like, I mean, this, right? This is, I mean, and not to jump to the end, but it's this that I'm seizing on this end of the movie quote here.
Can you hear them? They love you. They love you.
My little princess, I always knew you had it in you. Come on. Let's take you back.
How did no one see the blood on her before then?
Let's go get some help. Go get some help!
What did you do? What did you do?
I felt it.
What?
I let this clip play because of the chanting of her name. That's how the movie ends. The chanting of her name, all of that. It's very sad that's what it took. Check me here. Maybe I'm wrong, but isn't there something to be said for her to go out that way versus being the little girl who has to masturbate with her mother asleep in her room?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the better life?
I
don't know.
What are those my choices?
Because that's the choices.
I don't want her to be the little girl.
But those are the choices the movie sets up, though. I mean, that's the failure of the movie, of the mental health aspect of the movie, is that those are her only two choices. She either has to go out in this suicide scene, literally on stage, or she has to continue to, you know, have her mother keeping watch over her with her fucking music box.
There's a third choice where she moves out.
But that's not a choice, though, because she's a 20-something woman. She would have already moved out if that was a choice.
When
though.
She said that, though, I thought it indicated that this had been a discussion at some point when she was like, I'm moving out, like as if that wasn't like the first time she had ever said that.
It does. Yeah, it does. But I mean, to bring up the Greek comparison again, it's like what this story is. This is Icarus flying too close to the sun. And that is the point of that story. And we don't lament the loss of Icarus's life because that's not the parable. That's not what that represents. And
right.
No, I totally get, Mike, where you're coming from, because you listen to that and it's euphoric. I'm like, I'm very Lucille Bluth. I'm like, good for her, you know.
Well, and also, yeah. I mean, societally, I think that, you know, we brought this up and they don't really talk about society that much in all of this, but the idea that the entire community is cheering her choice has this other element of like, you know, right. approval. Like, yeah, we don't get it that you worked yourself to the point of death. We don't even get that.
We don't even care.
But we're approving of it, you right. know? Yeah, you're
well,
right.
Well, we were entertained, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
yeah. Like, bring Britney Spears up again.
Yeah, thanks for going the extra mile, because it was really exciting to watch, you know?
Sure, you had to shave your head, but Toxic was a fucking good song, yeah. though, you know?
Yeah, it was.
Listen, when I went to pull the audio, I hadn't really noticed. I hadn't, because that scene is the very last, that's the credits are rolling as the chanting is going on. And I hadn't noticed the chanting before, but as I was going to pull the audio, I left it because I was like, that's sick. But it's also, it is euphoric. It's euphoric from her. You understand why she is, I mean, the quote is, it's like, I felt it. Perfect. It was perfect. Like, those are her last lines. And the cheering of her crowd is also, again, is that real? Who knows? Are they really? I mean, I've ballet crowds are not known for their chanting people's names in the audience.
Exactly.
Go, girl! You get it! You fucking died like a winner! You know, like, no, that's not really what that vibe is. That's much more like New York football crowds. But, yeah.
I remember Mila's shock. The shock on Lily always stood out for me because it's so like, oh God, you know, like it's.
Well, yeah. Let's try and deconstruct the ending then, and then we should get to the wrap up and do our love it or leave it defenses. So the way it works out is she, quote unquote, kills Lily, right? So she slams her against the mirror again with the mirror imagery in this movie, which I love so much. She slams her against the mirror and then eventually sticks her with a shard of glass and kills Lily and then hides the body. This is between Act 1 and 2, where she has to become the Black Swan. And she has that great line as she's killing her. She says, it's my turn now. And then she goes on. She has this badass dance performance. She becomes the Black Swan on stage. It's a fantastically choreographed dance sequence. I love it.
That shot of with the wings, ugh.
Oh, and you so hear good. It. And something I didn't pick up on earlier is when she's orgasming and she's having, you know, Dear Diary, I had my first orgasm tonight. You see her skin start to model and it mm-hmm. starts to ripple, but then it goes away. That same skin effect happens now, except for it continues and the skin goes from modeling and it turns into the Black Swan feathers. So it really informs what that orgasm scene was. It was the next step along her becoming, like, you know, the baby bird out of the nest, baby bird starts to learn how to fly, baby bird becomes like a full grown bird. Like, when she orgasms, that's like the wings, the feathers underneath her are starting to, like, take hold, and she fully emerges as the Black Swan on stage. But it wasn't until I noticed the skin rippling effect in the dance sequence that it really made the orgasm scene make more sense, what that represented truly in her mind. But
well, and it even started that little, I kept calling it chicken skin in my head, but it started earlier than that. I mean, every time with the little scratch on her back, you know, that was obviously like the little sprouting of stuff, like the, you know, she had that chicken skin stuff going on. But you're right, it was like rippling through her body during that scene.
Right, because it looks painful, but it turns out it's a good thing. Well, it's a good thing from an awakening standpoint. Or at least her on her journey as she sees it, though, as it turns out. But so then she comes back and then we get the big twist. Lily's alive. Okay. But the glass is still broken. The mirror is still broken, even though Lily's alive. So some of what she imagined is fake. Some of what she thought happened really did happen. And then she notices the blood bloom on herself and she's wearing her White Swan costume. One, how does no one else see that? She's wearing the White Swan costume on stage. The blood is spreading from her torso in the dressing room. How does no one see that? What really happened there? Did she just stab herself? Does she smash the mirror and then stab herself? What do we think actually happened?
Well, I mean, no, I thought that's what happened. I thought that she basically, like, kind of, you know, had like this big explosive moment in the dressing room where she was just like, you know, after she falls on stage the way she does. And I understand that really he kind of dropped her, but also things kind of went awry there. She slips.
She wriggled herself out of his control, though. Yeah. Yes, he dropped her, but that was on her, though, I think.
Well, yeah. It's like whatever amount is like you're supposed to do your part as the partner being lifted as well. Like, yeah, there's a whole thing there. But I felt like, you know, she was like, really, truly, this was, you know, the moment where she was like, this is your final chance to get it together. And she just, I think she does smash the mirror. And whether it's consciously or not, I think she does injure herself. I mean, I have personally known a cutter before in my life, and that person would tell me, like, this is what I have to do to feel. Like, I can't feel the world unless I'm, like, cutting my skin. Like, that pain is, like, what brings the outside world in. And so for me, I feel like that's what she does. I mean, she literally cuts herself to feel the moment, to feel the pain, right, and then she can execute.
Well, I think it's that, but I'm gonna piggyback and then add to it. I think it's not only cutting to feel the pain to feel anything. I think it's cutting herself to feel the pain to complete her metamorphosis. I think there's a part of her, the same way she destroys her room in an imagined sex sequence there, where it must have just been by herself, which is so creepy that the mom is sitting at the table, clearly having listened all night to whatever her daughter was doing alone in the room. Think about that for a second. That's fucking weird. Yeah, I think she cuts herself to finish that transformation, though, that she can't do the suicide scene, right? And this was a hesitation that she had in rehearsal. She looks at Rothbart. She looks at the prince, and then she has to throw herself over the edge. She's very hesitant when we see her in the rehearsal doing that. Here, she knows she has to push herself to that next level to complete the process, to finish her story. She's become the Black Swan. She's reached her end of her journey, and now it has to be dead. It has to be done. The White Swan can't be allowed to return, and I think that's kind of all wrapped up into that.
That's how I've always taken it. And I mean, at a certain point by the end, the movie has become a third thing. And so it's sort of like it. And I guess that's why I keep coming back to this like Greek tragedy comparison, is because it's about the drama of it all. Because, I mean, if you're going to look at it realistically, it's like, well, I mean, they could take her to the hospital and she can get some stitches and be fine. And it's like, but that's not the point of the story at that point.
Right. More likely than not, she probably lives. More likely than not, if the movie is a real telling of a story.
Right. Or her brain tapped out. She accomplished what she meant to. Do you know what I mean? It just sort of it's the descent into madness. And back to kind of what you were saying earlier, it's what sets her free. So
it is the end of her story, no matter what actually happened after the camera turned off. It was the end of her story.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's fair. That's a fair assessment.
Two more, real or imagined. Is Thomas / Rothbart really fucking Lily on the side of the stage? Real or imagined?
No.
Imagined.
Does Beth really stab herself with a nail file and then somehow Nina winds up with the bloody nail file in the elevator, which really was the most disturbing part of it? Because
I don't want to break that one down, because I don't think I like the...
I think the Beth thing seems like it's imagined, but if that's imagined, does that add credence then the bloody nail file in the elevator is real?
Well, because what I take from that is that she attacked Beth.
Yeah, me too. Right. Me too. That was my takeaway.
I did want to just give like a round of applause to Winona Ryder, because this was at a point in her career where she was sort of transitioning, because Star Trek happened at the same time, where she was playing Spock's mother. And I thought she was great in this. It's not a flashy role, but it was just so cool to be like, oh, hey, Winona Ryder. Considering that she's playing the aging prima donna, I think Winona has handled this aspect and this transition of her career beautifully. I still am kind of like, oh, look, there she is. She's great. So I just get a kind of a thrill out of it.
I forgot she was in this, which is horrible. But when the first time I saw her back in the, you know, on the screen, I was like, hey, girl, what you been up to? I was happy to see her. You know, I forgot this entire small storyline of the aged ballerina. But it's so important, going back to the whole like growing up, not growing up, like seeing Beth and having the actual, you know, person standing here who's being pushed out. I mean, you can't just have the concept of aging out of ballet. You have having this person, this tangible person watching her descent here is so important to the motivation of what happens with Nina.
She's the cautionary tale that Thomas sets out, but she's also the objective that Thomas wants Nina to reach to. Mm. And so then Nina adopts that as her own objective, which is psychotic, right? Like, yeah, you know, yeah. she's perfect and dangerous and destructive, but also that's exactly what you need to be if you want to dance this role.
And you have to acknowledge that it's like, it's so clearly disposable. And then there's the male to female comparison where Thomas is arguably in his 50s. I mean, he's the same age as Beth is, but he's thriving and still sexually viable. And
right. He gets when his dancing career is over, he gets to become the core director, the ballet director. When Beth's retirement is over,
she walks into the street.
She walks into the street after some shitty words said at a gala dinner. Yeah.
But I also do want to point out or bring back up something that Caroline pointed out at the beginning, where it was like the older ballerina that was still teaching. And I think that scene with her is so important, and especially the lingering of the shot where you were talking about seeing the strength, but you could also
gorgeous.
Beautiful. I was gonna say you can see the age and the beauty. And so the movie does at least acknowledge that there is a third path, even though we don't really explore it. I think it's interesting. I think it's worth noting.
I agree with you. I agree with you very much. And
that's a path for Veronica, though. That's a path for Little Swan, though. That's not that's not a path for the Prima.
Maybe that's also, though, like, it's like what you see in it. So, like, to that end, like, yes, there was a path, but she couldn't see that path. You know, she was never going to see that path, even though that woman stood right in front of her for how long, teaching her the exact move, and she couldn't see that path.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, goes to all of our, you know, her psyche could not handle this.
Right. Well, but I mean, I just said it jokingly, but I think there's something to that, though. You know, Beth was the prima, and Beth, when she was now pushed out, she was done. Like, she had no value left the way she saw herself, the way Thomas saw herself. That means the way the company saw herself. She needed to literally disposable. It's Barbara Hershey's character. She's the woman who could have become the dance teacher. You know, never really rose too far. She never flew too close to the sun, so her wings were never melted. Nina could never, after becoming, striving and becoming this principal of the company, then become the dance teacher. You know, the ego-wise. You know, that's why I made it the joke that it was Little Swan, it was Veronica. Like, she's not going to be the principal, so she can have a continued career. She doesn't have to become disposable. She doesn't have to get thrown out after she's used up. She can stick around and continue to teach. Which is fucked up, right? You should be rewarded. If you've been this principal carrying this company and making it money, and the reason people come to see you season after season after season, there should be a retirement package for you. You should be able to continue to teach. And
she didn't even get her own going away party. It was piggybacked on by the debut of...
Right. Here's the old cow. We're kicking her out. And now we've got this young calf.
We don't say cow, we say heifer. That's what I was called all those years.
That's it.
Because that was the way to make a girl run faster is call her a heifer.
So the heifer and the calf.
Yeah.
So that age old tale.
Being led to slaughter, most quite literally.
I think we've worked through a lot of Black Swan. Now it's time for Love It or Leave It. Will, as our guest and our favorite guy who comes on podcast to talk about women being told to masturbate by men.
Oh my God.
I don't want this life.
Oh my God, you were so James Vanderbeek there, Varsity Blues. I don't want your life. Will, Black Swan, do you love it or leave it?
Love it.
Okay, well, why? Give me. Give me the 30-second elevator pitch. You've gotten in the elevator with me for whatever reason. We're talking about this movie.
It's so crazy. It's so indulgent. I love, because you were right when you said there wasn't a lot of gore, and it's like there's not. But where it is shocking. I mean, I had a friend who, when I first saw it, I was like, this movie was amazing, and she literally commented. She was like, I've seen Holocaust movies that have more levity than that movie did. I think it works as a serious art film. And I also think it works a little bit as like a midnight showgirls Rocky Horror. I mean, that for me is an accomplishment that you can achieve both. I love it.
Caroline, going to kick it over to you now. as a cheerleader, dancer, and not heifer, as a calf yourself, do you love it or leave it?
I love it. I think that this is absolutely a good recommendation for people. I love what you're saying, Will, about the idea that I think the first time I watched it more in that Rocky Horror Picture Show kind of way, where I was just enjoying it. You know, it was just a wild story, and this girl was having this adventure kind of thing. And then this time when I watched it, I think that I'm much more grown. I have a much better idea of this constant quest for perfection, I think, especially for women. I mean, the eating disorder is very glossed over, but the constant need to look a certain way. They comment on her weight a couple of times in the movie, and it's about her being thinner, but that isn't the common comment for women. So I think that there's a lot to this that would resonate with people. And also, in doing some research on this one, I hadn't really thought about how dance as an art isn't something that is able to be enjoyed outside of the moment. You have to be there. You have to see it. You have to be part of the performance. And, you know, I've read several quotes where it's like, you can't hang dance in a museum. You can't go back and visit it. It's not something that you can really keep with you in the same way that a beautiful painting or music or anything is enjoyed. So I think that is captured in this for me. She had that moment, and it doesn't even matter in some ways, like you guys were saying, that she dies at the end, because you can't keep that moment with you anyway. Like, it was done and gone. And so it was kind of okay that she was, because she had achieved what she was after. I also super appreciate showing, even if it was just small moments, the grittiness and the hard work and the dedication of dancers, how they, you know, they may be thin and small, but they are certainly not fragile. They, you know, they work so hard and they are so tough. So I think for all of those reasons, I give it a love it.
I agree with everything you guys have said. For me, I don't like horror movies. I love, love, love psychological thrillers, though. I think they fuck with your mind in a way that gory horror can't and never can. I like a movie that makes you start questioning your own sanity, makes you start wondering if what you're seeing is real. I think it really sucks you into the narrative. I think this movie well exceeds expectations in the story it's trying to tell. I think it does a great job of taking us on her journey as she fully commits to trying to become this ideal, but loses herself in a way. But maybe that's okay, and maybe it is harmful. It's not easy. I think there's a lot of good use of just narrative storytelling here that we didn't really get into it, but the way she's only dressed in white and everyone else wears colors in the beginning of the movie, but then she begins to wear grays and then she begins to wear dark colors as the movie progresses. I think that's so smart. It's so subtly conveying the story, and you're picking up on it without being aware of it. The use of the mirrors, I think, is such a good narrative device in this movie. But just the overall story, and then setting it in a ballet atmosphere, which, for people who know that dance is very competitive. It can be very toxic, like Will said at the beginning. It is punishing physically and mentally. All of that by itself, and you could have taken any of the core members and they could have had probably a psychological horror movie of their own. But making it then this woman who now has to carry this company and she has to break out and become this thing that she is not easy for her. I think it's a wonderful story. I think it's told in a really interesting way. And I think the performances are fantastic. I think Mila Kunis is great. I think Natalie Portman, she deserves the two awards. I mean, she won the Academy Award and the Golden Globe for Best Actress this year. I think it's well deserved. I think Vincent Cassel is amazing in this. So all of it just really comes together for me and gives a great Descent into Madness performance.
Whether or not this ending, whether it's satisfying, happy, sad, you know, what have you, another point for it being kind of a happy ending is if she's dead, she's not going to age out of this. She's not going to go the way of Beth. Like, she's legendary. She achieved perfection and now she's done. Yeah.
She escaped the core that her mother never escaped. And she escaped being pushed out into the street, literally, that Beth didn't escape.
Which is the end of Swan Lake. This is fairy tale fodder. And as evidenced by the fact that Odette is the character in my novel Fairy Tale.
I love that. Will, tell us more about this. Because I've been waiting to hear updates and I haven't heard any in a while.
Well, it's out.
Tell me everything. Please tell our listeners.
Yeah, so I wrote a book. It took me a long time, but it's called Fairy Tale. And it's the way I pitch it to people is it's kind of like Gossip Girl meets Game of Thrones. It's like a collision of those two worlds. But it's a modern milieu and it's the fairy tale princes and princesses. It takes place with them all concurrently, and some of their stories have already happened, some of them haven't happened yet, but they're sort of woven through into one coherent thread. And there might be an evil queen, there might be there's kind of like, I pitch it as very fashion, fantasy, adventure, humor, like that kind of thing. And it's not for children. There's language, it is dealing with more adult subject matter, however it's not like one of those novels. It's very, but yeah, Odette is one of the key the princesses. And I'm not going to say you can tell that I had watched this movie while I was watching it, but you know, I think elements of it do. I ended up merging Odette's character with the older fairy tale, The Seven Swans and The Ugly Duckling. So she ends up being an amalgamation, but I'm very passionate, very proud of it, if I do say so myself. And
we're very proud of you for doing this. We've been with you now for some period of time here when you were still working on it. So It's amazing, amazing that you finished it. Congratulations.
Will, actually, but where can people find you on social media? Where can they find So I'm Watching the Show? Where can they find Fairy Tale? I mean, we can put links to it in the show notes and we will.
Sure.
But give us your pimp yourself.
I am at Willow719, W-I-L-L-O 719 on Twitter and Instagram, most all of it. And then So I'm Watching the Show is at So I'm Watching, either SoI'mWatching.com or the Twitter handle is at So I'm Watching. And if you go to soimwatching.com, all of our stuff links out from there. The book is on Amazon. We have it in e and paperback. And it's long. I will say it's long, but it's easy. It's like a beach read. I would love if people enjoyed it and let us know.
We'll definitely go out there, guys, and get it. We will have links to the show notes so you guys can easily buy it. Thanks so much, Will, for coming on and talking to us. Maybe we'll find something that doesn't involve bizarre sexual picadillos next time.
Oh, man.
I don't know. I mean, Dickinson is on the horizon. I know you guys cover that over on So I'm Watching the Show.
Well, but we didn't do season two. We only covered season one. So.
Well, hey, we could certainly use you on season two. Over
y'all here, might so. Be seeing Will back in April, is all Anytime. I'm saying.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Will.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for listening to Love It or Leave It March Madness Edition, because we all go a little crazy sometimes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Pod Clubhouse Podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you could leave us a 5-star rating, that would be fantastic, so we don't have to put you into a plate of glass and stab you.
Oh, no. One step ahead of you.
Yes.
Oh, I recorded a perfect podcast.
Nina, Nina, Nina.
We have to be like, Will,
Nina.
Will.
Let go. Gosh. Let go.
Oh, gosh.
Seriously, yo, guys, don't make us seduce you. Seduce us. All right. We'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.